are rolling.
Good afternoon. It is 1:26 p.m. on February 24th, 2020. We are here at the Motor House in Baltimore on 120 West North Avenue. I am Jennifer Ray Lucas, a part of the Urban Arts Leadership 2020 cohort. Urban Arts Leadership is a program of the Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance directed by Kabibi Ajanku and funded by the National Endowment for the Arts. I am sitting here with Kayla Fryer on sound. Runs Balagtas?
Balagtas.
Mm-hmm. Incorrect. I am sorry again. Okay. On our videography and photography. Liz Dunlap, Kelly Palmer, and Bintu Kuyate, and Miss Hunter, who has so graciously allowed us to interview her today. Thank you, welcome.
Thank you.
And I see, just to set the scene, you have two dolls here and one bag and a very illustrious hat with a mix of dolls, and I can't see everything, but it's really amazing. Would you mind telling us about that hat?
All right, I'll start with that. As stated, my name is Barbara Hunter, and I have been I started out to be a textile chemist, but my father bought me a sewing machine in 1960, and I do with a piece of cloth what a painter does with a canvas. And that seems to have been my passion from that time on, which was 1960. So my hat is not recent. This is about 80 years old. And it's made from mud cloth, and it's lined on the inside. And as I make dolls, I started making dolls some years ago. And this is my travel hat. No matter where I am in the world, my doll family goes with me. They are pins at this point, but they do have bodies. But I leave the bodies at home because the bodies would be hanging all over my face if I didn't. So they don't have specific names as such, but I have a tendency to put them on my hat and wear them. And it is a conversation piece that a lot of little kids will oftentimes, when I'm in the airport and I wear my hat, as your parents used to say, don't point. And they will be pointing at my hand, and the parents would say, well, don't point, you know. But if they come up to me, I will tell them the story of these dolls. And so it's been a very beneficial thing to me, because I went to the craft show yesterday at the convention center, and I think I spent more time talking about my hat than anything else. So this is the last one that I have. I do have to make some more. But it will take time, and because I'm a sort of a thorough person, and I like to do things from, as you say, from scratch. I'm very blessed to be able to construct my own drawings as well as my own patterns. Even though I have been formally trained, I am pretty much self-taught in the contemporary kind of things that are coming out now. Yeah.
Do these particular dolls that you have on this hat?
No, other than the fact that this was in my formative years where I started really doing dolls. Because primarily when I taught in high school for 36 years, I taught what is now an ancient subject called home economics. And I taught kids to sew practically anything that they wanted to. Although in my classes, I could have taught very simplistic according to our directors and curriculum, but I thought kids could do more. So my kids were at the point of they could either stay 1 year or one semester and all 4 years if they actually worked their program so that they could stay longer.
Okay. I want you to think about something. Don't stop recording. She gave you an N, right? We have to go back and reestablish. What was the N? What did she give you?
She gave us that she taught for 36 years.
And what else? What word did she use even before that? Do you remember?
Home economics.
Her formative years.
Mm-hmm.
So, right. right,
okay.
Good.
Okay, okay.
So take her back.
The right place.
Take her back where? Formative.
Do you understand my question?
Yeah, I think it's okay.
Okay, go.
Okay.
Try.
Oh, wait, oh,
wait,
yes,
wait, 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 Liz, go ahead, try.
So, since you said your dad gave you your sewing machine, has sewing always been a passion for you?
Yes, in a way. My grandmother was the type of person that when school closed in my hometown where we were staying, the minute school doors closed, my parents took us up to her home to spend the summer. So we very seldom spent the summers in my original home until school time. So in the summertime, my grandmother was a very flexible person, and I think I got my creativity from that side of the family. And she would keep what you don't know about now is a nice little green switch. And she would just kind of cut you if you thought about doing something wrong. In those days, I don't remember getting any spankings as such, which is, you know, jail time now. But it afforded me to focus my interest in some area. We had what you call a treadle sewing machine. You have to look that up on the internet, the machine that had the foot pedal that went like this. We did have electricity and all that kind of stuff, but I preferred the sound of the treadle machine. So she would just leave bits of fabric, and once she taught me to thread the sewing machine, when she heard the sewing machine working, she knew what I was doing. I had two brothers and two cousins that were outside raising all kinds of heck around the place. But if I didn't want to play with them, I could entertain myself by working on the sewing machine. She did teach me some things, but primarily at that time I was self-taught. I was very fortunate to go into elementary school in those days and actually start my interest in sewing and art in the fifth grade. You know, now you're lucky if you can get into it in ninth grade or any years up until your 12th year in school. Right now it's environmental science. Last year, I'm not sure what it is this year, but they keep changing the title to make it suit today's, you know, lifestyle and students as such. So, back in that day, it was something that everybody did because a lot of the chefs and so forth that we got from that time were from the boys and girls who took nutrition. You learned to eat healthy before it became fashionable, and you also learned to cook a proper meal from the beginning to end. I was fortunate, and in summertime, my aunt had a big garden, and we very seldom. I didn't even really eat frozen food until I went off to college, because we had fresh food every day. So that was interesting too for her. Yes.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Okay. So, just a few things you said. So you said your grandma kept a switch. I'm just wondering because normally, like my grandma always tells me that she had to pick hers. So I'm wondering where outside was.
Well, she did not. She was a housewife at
right.
that time. She didn't have to work. My grandfather worked as a munition person,
mm-hmm.
and if you're familiar with DuPont nylon factory, at the time that he was working, it was then a munitions factory where they came and got ammunition for World War II. So consequently, that was his job in addition, and he had a farm. And on the farm was pigs and chickens and the usual things, a cow or two, maybe a horse. But we always had a garden, maybe about as long as this building.
Okay.
So it was.
Go
yeah.
ahead.
So
I want to stop you for one second.
Yes.
Okay? This
mm-hmm.
is because they're learning to do this at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
There's some foundation questions that. Go ahead.
Yeah. just to walk it back some for some context, could you tell us where you were born?
Oh. I was born in Richmond, Virginia, my father lived in Richmond. My mother lived out what we call Chesterfield County, which was on old Route 1, and like Silver Spring is to Maryland, to D.C., and it was sort of like that. I'm not sure where they met, but they married, and I think I was born in June. I was born in June, and he was becoming a student at Columbia. He had won a full scholarship to Columbia in New York for law. So we moved to New York at that time, and I think he finished in 2 years or 3 years. And we, once he finished at Columbia, graduated, and he took the bar in Virginia, North Carolina, and Washington, D.C., we moved to North Carolina.
So you said this was your brother or your father?
My father, Okay. Yeah. Yeah. He finished Columbia at 19, mm-hmm. because he finished high school when he was 14.
What field?
Well, it was segregated schools,
right.
And but he did live with his parents, but his aunts took over his livelihood because he was such a vibrant person that he went to live with them, and as a result, they gave him opportunities for education that his parents didn't necessarily do. They were workers, but at that time they were poor. And managed a family, but they had a lot of children. So they took and kept, and he stayed with them during the school years. And then when we went to New York, he graduated from Columbia. And he took three bars, as I said, and passed all of them, but he chose North Carolina as his place of career. He set up his own office at that time, and he was primarily a person who gave legal counsel to the people in the community about their welfare and what they could do, because most of them, they weren't slaves, but they did not have much education. So that was his, I guess, giving back. And that's how he lived. My mother didn't have to work, but she was a librarian in the area where our home was. It was a small library, like a little neighborhood thing. So she worked there a couple of afternoons when it was open, but she sewed primarily for the family. You know, my grandmother was the person who could just put a piece of fabric on the table and cut out a garment.
Okay, you know. Mm-hmm. Thank you. What's missing? Do you remember? What threw us off? The timeline.
Mm-hmm. Timeline.
Okay. So what's the go ahead.
The question about what they were, the community was coming to.
Okay, but even before that, what do you need to ask her?
Actually, what year?
Her father.
I was born in. We were in North Carolina in 1943, and Raleigh was our first place. Where we had a home, apartment first, then we went into an actual house. He did carry his law practice in Raleigh, but he did teaching in School of Law in North Carolina Central in Durham, which at that time was like 30, 40 minutes away. You know, so he could do both, and he did.
Let's go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
How old were you at the time?
How old was I?
Yeah.
I had to be about 3, maybe 4, mm-hmm. Because of I was in school in 4 at that time, because I finished high school when I was 16. Mm-hmm. So they put me in school because kind of didn't know what to do with me. And at that time, we didn't have daycare, and, you know, you had play dates and so forth, but you got tired of all that. At least I did. And so I spent a lot of time drawing and coloring and painting and, you know, just on my own. You don't know a thing about it, but back in the day, clothing came from your cleaners in paper bags, the length of the garment, so that my grandmother would always cut the paper in, you know, drawable sizes, and that's what my first drawing paper was. Mm-hmm. And I used crayons and paint, watercolor paints, and sort of just taught myself until I really, you know, got into school. And at that time, the elementary schools were fully taught, and art as well as math and science were not ignored. You know, you had music classes, you had art classes, as well as your English, math, and the other things too. So you got, I think, even though it was segregated, you got a well-rounded education. So that was good. And then your parents, at that time, other lessons out in the community were not that expensive, so you really could go to the choral group or the soccer group or the this and that, you know, kind of thing. So children had a lot of opportunities. I spent most of my time in the fabric store, in the library, and at any kind of art supply store that we had. All segregated. Everything was segregated.
Thank you. Kelly, do you know what year she was born in? Ask that question.
What year were you born?
1940.
1940, that's what mm-hmm. I
said. And what was do you know what was going on in the country then? Ask her.
Well, World War II, it was, I'm not sure exactly, I don't remember exactly, it was either near the middle of it, because around, my brother was born in 1941, and then after that, we were always free to move around as such, but things didn't seem to be so regimented because of the fact the war had changed places. And when I told you about the DuPont nylon plant or munitions plant, they, as soon as they got rid of all the weapons and so forth, they turned it into a nylon plant, and they made parachutes along with nylon stockings. See, so it they didn't tear it down like some other places would have torn down their manufacturing facilities. So it had multiple uses, which, and it's still standing now. I go home every few often. It has changed, but it is still standing and still pretty much not doing parachutes, but other types of nylon products like that. Yeah.
You've established that she was born in 1940. How old was your father when you were born?
He must have been about 30. No, he had to be young because he went to Columbia that long. I think he was like at the end of his 20s, maybe 29, 30, something like that.
So let's subtract 30 from 1940.
And my mother was older. She was 7 years older.
She was older than mm-hmm. he was? Mm-hmm. And how did that happen?
Good question. I'm not aware of that.
So you
get some family history, but you don't get everything talked about as such. And at back in the day, you asked some questions, but you knew sometimes you just knew what not to ask. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
but that's pretty significant. That means that her mother, if he's born in 1910, the mother would have been.
She was born in 1912.
He was born, but he was 30 years older than you, right?
No, she was older than he was.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
If you're born 1940.
Yeah.
Okay, and he's 30 years older. Approximately.
Approximately, I said I don't remember
okay,
that much
about. Okay, she's 7 years older than him.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because she was born. In February, the year the Titanic sank.
Okay.
I do remember that because we had a trunk that saved the actual paper from the Titanic. And am I moving? Of course, I've lost it. But we had the actual issue of the Time Dispatch, which was the paper, local paper at that time, of the sinking of the Titanic. Mm-hmm. So
the paper.
I would have to go through all of our archives, as I say, throwing out through stuff and looking back through stuff. You know, you'd have to go back through, you know, for a lot of things. Yeah. Okay.
Now remember who she is and what you're trying to get. What are you trying to get from her? Why are we interviewing her? Because she's what? She's part of the Great Migration Movement,
mm-hmm.
and she's an artist, right? An artist, and what kind of art? Art is right in front of you. You don't need me to do this part. You can progress it. You can push the conversation forward now.
So my question is, what transformed you from going from painting and drawing and then to begin to create your dolls?
that became, as I said, as long as I had brown paper from the grocery store and the cleaners, I had multiple papers because, you know, everything was free as far as that was concerned. And I've always had dolls. That my family bought me dolls because I actually played with dolls. But they were all white. Or they were Caucasian with a slight tint to their faces as such. The only dolls I had of color were made by my grandmother because she sewed. And I had a lot of Raggedy Ann dolls, the original dolls, pretty much of the Southern community. And I had dolls of all sizes from 6 inches to 24 inches. And I just got tired of the white doll. And since I had access to paper and crayons and pencils, I drew my own. And then the paper was flimsy, so I could take the cardboard. I would take cardboard out of anything and glue them onto the cardboard so that they were firm as far as designing clothes is concerned. And it was like we lived outside the city, about, as I say, a mile from the DuPont factory. But every Saturday, my grandfather, they would go into South Richmond, which was on the south side of the James River, between that and Petersburg, Virginia, which is a little bit down the road from Richmond and whatnot. And we would stay in town practically all day, and the one treat we got, of course, was lunch, because there was one black restaurant on the street was called Hull Street, Hull Street, and we were able to eat lunch. And if we didn't have lunch, we would take sandwiches and have it in a park that they had near there, or we would hurry up and finish all of our chores and then get back in the car and go home. Our grandmother would have a very sumptuous lunch waiting for us. So we ate well, and I don't know of any time that we were not able to do things socially. The town on the south side had, they had a bank, they had grocery stores, they had what we call like 7-Eleven, where you could get pickup snacks and so forth and things like that. And they had a department store. Department stores were garments that were made, I'm not sure where, because I'm not a shopper, and never have been. I have gone in the store with my aunt and so forth, and they would either purchase a dress if they liked, but if they didn't like it, they would buy fabric and come home and make it. So I got in the habit of doing that. And as I said, I started sewing quite young. I guess I was about six or seven, as my grandmother would leave scraps of fabric, and I would sometimes put them together, not necessarily putting a garment together. It looked like a garment, but it wasn't. And I would put it on my doll, and then I would just simply play with her. And not only just having a female doll, but I made the whole family, the whole family who I wanted to play with. And it was just a passion. It started being a passion for me, because the dolls, the art, and painting and sewing all seemed to go together to me. I didn't know really any difference. And a lot of times I was able to write when I was about 3 or 4, not because I had formal training, but because I could see it in my mind how letters looked and actually form words. So I have been writing and reading for quite a number of years. Yeah.
How old were you when you first started selling your dolls?
Mm-hmm. I didn't start selling my dolls until about 2010, because I was in the high school, and I was more about fostering the skills and talents of my students, mm-hmm, more than myself. And my dolls just simply took a back burner. You know, I've always done it. I belong to an organization called the National Association of Fashion and Accessory Designers. It's called NAFAD, N-A-F-A-D for short, Incorporated. And when I became a member of that in 1971, we did fashion shows. The members were about 15 to 20 people, and they were primarily not sewing for clientele as I do, but they were sewing for family and for self. And I came on board I tried to join them when I when I got out of Howard, but they said I was too young because I finished Howard at 20. And so they at that time, there were a lot of seasoned ladies. And they weren't used to young people kind of butting in and, you know, taking a place in there. So I just let it slide. And after I graduated from Howard, I went on to Fashion Institute of Technology in New York. And at that time, I was the only person of color in my class. And, of course, you know, they kind of raised some eyebrows and they wanted to know, why are you here? And most of the students in my class were fresh out of either junior college or high school. And I usually don't tell people what I do, and I didn't. So you know how you go into class, and I said, write on the back of your student card on a piece of paper what your background is, kind of a mini resume. So I would turn a page and a half in, and they would, sometimes the teachers would read these little tidbits off the classes, and I would always put mine on the bottom. And so she started reading. She would read about 5 or 6 things for each person, but then she started reading mine and read the whole thing because I had done, you know, all of those things at early age because I went to FIT. I think I was 20. I was 20, yeah. So they say, you've done all of this in such a short time? I said, yeah. You know, but I had to kind of reserve my status in class because I knew I knew more than the students did because they were fresh out of families, a Jewish family or this family who owned businesses in the apparel industry. So consequently, I didn't want to, not necessarily overstep my bounds, but I tried, you know, to downplay what the assignments were. So the teacher would give an assignment, your research or whatever you had to do, and we had lab classes that were 4 or 6 hours long. So when I came back to the next class, all my work was done because I was accustomed to, you know, keep my ladder full, and I can multitask at the time before the word became a part of Webster. Mm-hmm. You know, so that allowed me to get a lot of things done. At FIT, I only went a year, but I took millinery, I took foundation wear, I took textile dyeing, textile chemistry, I took physics, I took everything I could take in that particular time because I didn't know where I was going to end up. I really didn't know where I was going to end up. And so when I graduated from FIT, Ebony Magazine was calling for designers for their traveling fashion show at that time. And I just told my mom, I said, I'm going to send them some drawings. And I said, all they can tell me is no, because I wasn't particularly known, you know, for any particular design student. And at that time, we had Fashion Institute, we had Pratt, and a couple of other smaller sewing schools that were around town. But I've always wanted to go to FIT. And I told my mom, I said, if I can get in, that's where I'm going. Mm-hmm. I applied to all the schools that I had gone to, and I didn't ask. I said, this is where I'm going. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was my focus during that particular time to go there. And a lot of my advisors and instructors said, well, you can't do this and you can't do that. I said, okay. And then I would go back to my room and rearrange my schedule. And so it worked out. Now, it kept me there from 8 o'clock in the morning to sometimes 6 or sometimes 8 in the evening. But New York at that time wasn't bad as far as being around as a single person. And I was lucky enough to live on the IRS line, which would be equivalent to our red line today. So FIT was here, but I could stay on the same train and, you know, take it uptown to my residence. And I didn't have to do a lot of walking in the streets. I was staying. At that time, they didn't have dorms. And so therefore, I stayed at the YWCA, and I had a little efficiency in that particular. And I remember that it being at 50th and 7th Street in Manhattan. So the best thing I ever did when I went to school was I took my sewing machine. And that was the first time that the miniskirt came out. Mm-hmm. And nobody knew how to do the miniskirt. Mm-hmm. So I made a lot of money doing the miniskirt. So I took a full schedule. I went to Howard, you know, I was supposed to be there five and a half years, but I went regular school time, September to June, and then I went some summers.
What was your major?
At that time, it was clothing and textiles, and art and design was my minor. I learned from Lois Jones Pierre Noel, who was a great artist, a Haitian artist from that particular time. I loved her. She was my art teacher. And I managed to matter whatever she was teaching that semester, that's what I took regardless. So I got training in a lot of things. And then at Howard, I joined the Ira Ulrich Theater. And I did their first play called Blood Wedding. And I did the costumes for that. And in addition to going to school and in addition to everything else, I never had a bad GPA. I never got lower than a B, because if I had a C or a D, I would have cardiac arrest. So I made it a point. Now, I had some good roommates, but I also lost a lot because they came there to get a doctor, lawyer, in and chief for a husband. I was not there for marriage. I was there for a career. Mm. And at that time, people said, well, I think my father, as being a lawyer, he wanted me to be a lawyer, too. He thought I would be. And he didn't stop me from going to into clothing and textiles, but I don't think he really understood my passion for it. So eventually, after they saw my fashion shows and things in my sketches and things that I carried around, then he never really said yes, but he didn't back down either. Yeah.
Did Howard have the homecoming fashion show then?
No.
Okay.
We gave it within the home economics department. They didn't start doing those until about the 70s.
Okay.
Yeah, about the 70s, because I was teaching at Woodrow Wilson High School at that time. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the year, they would have an all-city fashion show dealing with all the senior high schools and junior high schools in the city. So my kids were always a part of it. Mm-hmm. And I made sure that, as I said, I could teach an apron, a skirt, and a blouse. But my kids went with evening gowns, coats, suits, and I mean, not just silly things. I mean, really, really good garments. Mm-hmm. And because they were giving out trophies and so forth. My kids won first prize every year. I said, we're not going for a T-shirt and a pair of shorts. Mm-hmm. I said, the junior high schools, of course. But it depended on the teacher. You know, if you mm-hmm. pushed your kids, you got what you needed to get. Mm-hmm. And I knew they could do, because I said, I want you to be better than me. Mm-hmm. And I had an opportunity to push many of them, and I knew most of their parents, so the parents got to they understand that my focus. I said, if you can be a lawyer or engineer or whatever your career will be. And I had one young lady who really had a very hard time with her parents because she wanted to go into being a surgeon. And her parents just did not want her to take clothing and textiles. They saw no use of it. So I said, well, once your thing, I said, you can tell your parents that you're going to be the neatest person to stitch a person up mm-hmm. because you understand the mechanics of hand and eye coordination. Mm-hmm. See, so she went on to do that. And then I had other young men who became designers. One is an art designer for, at that time, album covers, you know, the ones that the big records came on. Mm-hmm. I still talk to some of them because some of them call me to see if my telephone number is still the same.
Mm-hmm. How did you went to New York?
Yeah.
And then after graduating from
FIT,
FIT,
I went on to send those drawings into fashion to Ebony Magazine, and out of the seven, they picked five. And then I took a sample in of my work, and at that time, they not only looked at how good you looked on the outside, but they wanted to know what your garment looked on the inside. Mm-hmm. So my garments you could wear inside out. Mm-hmm. So that at that particular time, they called me up, and I didn't expect any kind of response other than the fact that thank you for participating and that kind of thing. And they called me up and asked me would I be interested in going on the road. And I talked to my mom, and she says, you know, because we were living in New York, we eventually moved to New York, and she was living there. I said, if you could manage, you know, the household, which was just an apartment for her and me, I would go on the road, at least try it, you know. So they bought me a sewing machine, but I took my own because I knew what my sewing machine would do. Mm-hmm. And then I've been to all the states except eight. And I wore I wore my colors, usually pink and green, because I'm an AKA. And so every city that I went to, they asked me, is there any city you can go into where you don't know somebody? You know, and that felt good. That really felt good. But yeah, go ahead.
Speaking of cities, when did you come back to this area?
I came back to this area because my daughter was seven, and I had her tested, you know, like Huntington Learning Center, that kind of stuff. And we lived in Brooklyn in New York, and everything in Manhattan was always an hour away. So I felt, after a lot of traveling back and forth up here and kind of finding what was open, I decided that I would move back into this particular area because I could offer her things here that I could afford, but I couldn't afford in New York. Because no matter what you did in New York, Brooklyn at that time was like a satellite place. You know, you talk about Brooklyn and it's like a foreign country. And you didn't have as many opportunities. You had the same opportunities, but everything involved taking a bus or a train or something like that, which was always an hour or 45 minutes out of, you know, out of the way. So I decided to come here so I could give her. She studied dance with Jones Hayward School of Ballet, which was on Georgia and Delafield Street, Northwest. And she started out with simple classes as a child, toddler. Not a toddler, but they were 3 or 4 years old. And then her lessons, they charged, of course, and but her lessons start. Then they saw her skills and wanted her to be there 7 days a week. And that was not in my salary. So I told them I had skills in sewing and so forth. So they hired me as a residence wardrobe person. So that's why I got to work off some of her payments, and I worked for the performing company, which they had at the time, called Capital Ballet. Yeah.
So what do you mean when you said tested? Because, like, I'm like, wait, hold on.
Like what?
Like, you said you went to get your daughter tested.
Tested. I wanted to find out what her academic capabilities were. Okay. Like Huntington Learning Center does that now, to find out where your kids were placed. Like the SAT and the you know, those kind of tests that they give you now. But she was always very good in school. She was an avid reader, but I wanted to see what her capabilities were. She never skipped a grade, but I made sure that she was able to get a good foundation of whatever she was going to do. You know, so that's why I said I had her tested right there. But just to find out what she was capable of. When I brought her here from New York, she was reading on the sixth or seventh grade level. So, and she still is an avid reader today. So I thought it was a good thing to do. And I didn't go further south because in Virginia and in parts of North Carolina, it was like watching paint dry. People don't do anything, you know, other than church, job, and gossip. And that's not me. You know, if you want to talk to me, you call me on the phone. I don't even pay anything for this thing. I don't even pay anything for texting, because I'd rather talk to you than you know, texting. Because if I got to read that, I'm just taking time off of what I'm doing.
I ask you a question? What inspires your art?
What inspires my art?
Mm-hmm.
Everything. I am a person. This is a little black book that I carry, and I've got some days I feel like eyes, and some days I feel, you know, like different things, and I will sketch whatever I come across. It's always some kind of fashion that's in here, and I take notes in here. If I see something, maybe a collar from this, maybe a head drape or something like that, that could end up being a cowl collar on something, you know, and I believe in clothing that starts in one function, but if I were to pull it down, it could become something off of my shoulders on just a plain dress. At that time, the little black dress was developed, and so people would kind of use the little black dress for everything. So consequently, the little black dress, for those who couldn't draw particularly, afforded us a lot of background. That's it. And wherever I see African art or any kind of art, I'm not inspired by anybody in particular, because when I was at Howard, I would go down to Union Station at that time and just kind of sit around in the lobby and just watch people. And people to me were always very fascinating. So I got a lot of information, you know, just from people watching. And sometimes I would sketch the person, sometimes I would just sketch something about the hairline, or for instance, like you, I would be sketching your head around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, see, so those kind of things that were interesting to me. And I carry this book wherever I go. It's been to South Africa, it's been to Paris, it's been to Germany, you know, any, everything. As I say, you see all kinds of little papers and things stuck in. Mm-hmm. If it's art related, I've got something of it. Mm-hmm. You know, so this is why I do it. You want to talk about this?
Yeah. Sure.
Yes. Okay. Please. This is a handbag that I made from scratch. I had a bunch. I went to the architect's office down on, I think, C Street, not down from about one or two blocks from the Smithsonian. And every once in a while, they will give out some of their sample books. Now, they throw them in the trash. So I told them, you know, to consider throwing them to me. So I got one or two books. I was with a class at that particular time. And so we bought the books back. And so that's why there's so many colors and so many textures and so forth in here. And this is swimsuit fabric.
Oh.
This is swimsuit fabric. And so I decided to put to not just put a clasp on it, but to make it kind of interesting for a person to just kind of walk. Everybody walks up and pinches the arms, you know, because they're not quite sure what they do. But inside is lined, and the straps are of many different kinds of fabric, so that works out. This is Zebra Diva, and her hair is braid from the fabric store that you might see on curtains, mm-hmm. on pillows, things like that. So I will make hair, and I use this kind of hair because it's twisted, but I also can get many, many colors. Mm-hmm. And she can stand. I didn't bring my stand with her, whatnot, but she does stand, and her hands are able to bend. This one has no wire armature in it, although now I'm working with a different kind of a doll that has a wire armature in it. The only difference on this one is that she has balsa wood in her heel. That's what makes her actually stand, because there's wood in her heel. So she has her own attitude. She doesn't always want to sit up. Or not, yeah. But I have a couple of dolls like her. And in her back is a rod, like when you get at the cleaners and you get your pants over those rods, that's what I use for it, to make her sit up. In the back of her is what we call a casing, and I leave it open so I can stick the rod up there to allow her to sit, you know, or stand if I have a longer one. Her face is painted, and my dolls have a tendency to look the same. You know, as far as the eyes are concerned, I, as I said, can't always get away from my book. This is just a doll, and this is a paper ruffle. This is paper ruffle, and this is what we call a topsy-turvy. Topsy-turvy. So when I turn her over, and this was a doll of the slave culture, mostly from Jamaica, Haiti, South Carolina, Florida, Alabama, you name it, because the slaves at that time didn't have toys, and all the plantation owners' children had toys, but they came from France, England, and anywhere in Europe. The black children, they were allowed them around on most plantations, but they didn't have anything to play with. And so the topsy-turvy doll, it became popular. You could put Little Red Riding Hood, and then you could put the wolf on the other side. Mm-hmm. You could put Cinderella up here, and you could put the stepmother on the other side. Mm-hmm. So it lends itself to many, many things. I've got to improve this pattern because she's a little bit broad, because she does take a lot of material. But the skirt is just sewn, and they're connected at the waist. So you can turn it either way, and whatever trim I have left, I simply add it to the bottom, and it kind of completes it. So I make the two fabrics are compatible, so this fabric is not bad with that either. Mm-hmm. See, so it can combine with that. And generally you'll have one side awake and one side asleep, but I like mine awake. So generally I do make some small dolls, which are about 6 inches, but I prefer to make the larger doll. Most of my dolls are this size, which is about 22, 24, because I like my dolls to sit. I do have one that's horizontal, and she lays on your bed, and she's like this. And then the body's all one piece, but she's like you may see a model laying on, you know, on the beach like that. All the girls in Sports Illustrated draped on a car, you know, that kind of thing. And so she would, the only part that's movable on her is, you know, would be her head. With the classes I'm taking now at Montgomery College, I'm learning to use wire for armatures, and so they can bend, you know, in any direction that you wish. But I still prefer the soft sculpted. She doesn't have any wire in it, except for the heels has wood. But I prefer just the stuff and use them. This doll has popsicle sticks in the back of her head. That allows her, because technically the neck is kind of small. So I just use a popsicle stick and insert it here, and it's also inserted on that one, too. Something like that. But it's fun to make that on Friday nights when everybody's going to the club and so forth. I can just pull out some fabric and just kind of entertain myself, you know. And I did my clubbing days when I was your age. But but I'm not. And I, as I said, I will be 80 in June. But sometimes, you know, I still, you know, age is a number. And if I feel like I want to go to line dancing class our church, very fortunate, is that it has family night. And the kids, as well as elementary, middle school, and high school, and adults will come there, and we'll have line dancing or something like that. As long as they have refreshments, the place will be full. but I sometimes will go to that. But, you know, people say, well, sometimes I say, well, I'm too old. I said, no, I'm not. As long as I feel good and I'm not sick, you know, I can get up and go. And but this is like a pleasure to me. God gave me this gift, and I don't question it. It's something I've had. I can't even tell you when it began. I tell you my 3 or 4 years of old, but of age. But it's just something I have a passion for. Even at my age now, I still, you know, want to continue doing it. I don't know what's on my bucket list, and I guess God has something for me. But somewhere down the road. But I guess when I do go into the pearly gates, I better have a couple of dolls with me, because he might not recognize me or me without my hat or a couple of my dolls with me, you know. But as I say, it's a pleasure. But my main focus nowadays is pushing young people to see their potential. As I say, you can be an engineer, an astronaut, or whatever, but whatever level you want to enter the thing, just have a passion about it and continue, yes.
What do you teach?
What do I teach?
Where?
Oh, where? Mm-hmm. Oh, now, I was in 6 schools, but right now I'm in 1 school, which is Northwood High School on University in Arcola. In fact, they called me this morning, did I want to work? And I said, no, I got to go to Baltimore.
How are you working in 6 schools?
I don't work, a substitute.
Oh, gotcha.
So it's nice I can work no Mondays, no Fridays,
nice,
which is kind of good.
Yeah.
You know, and they've been offered a vacancy, but I won't take that because it means I don't have to give up doing stuff like this. Mm-hmm. So, yes.
Can I ask, how many pieces do you have in total that you've made?
Oh, I can't even tell you, because I've done weddings and prom dresses since 2000, and I don't photograph all of my work, and I can't even begin to tell you. If I do one year, I do remember I did 12 prom dresses for Roosevelt High School, Coolidge, and some of the other schools around there. And at my particular school, Woodrow Wilson, all the girls loved this one dress that had big roses, cabbage roses around the top of it. And I made that dress 5 times, but I wouldn't tell them who was wearing it. Everybody was in a different color. And I was lucky enough to have a big room so I could fit at school. They didn't have to come to my house. I could do everything at school so they could go home. And so, but when they came from other schools, I had them to come there. But it was a pleasure. But that year, I made those 5 dresses. And like it was, you know, I kept saying, "Please, don't let anybody walk in here while I'm fitting," you know, and whatnot. Yes. Okay.
I have a question. So, have you ever displayed your dolls in exhibition?
Yes, I've been in the Smithsonian downtown, in the Sumner School, which is on 17th and. Something 17th and 17th and H. I think that's the one that goes all the way across town. H or M, something like that. And right now we're in Sandy Springs Museum, up in Sandy Springs, Maryland. And I've done a whole lot more since I've met my friend Camilla. And but I enjoy doing this. In fact, now I've got to go make more because our exhibition seemed to be coming a little closer than we thought. And so I want to keep some that I can take with me at all times. But I thank you.
Thank you.
I've enjoyed today. And I think you've got a great start in your various careers, whatever they may be. Yeah, you're going to do very well. Thank you.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Okay. Well, for our official closing, once again, my name is Jennifer Ray Lucas. I am sitting with the 2020 Urban Arts Leadership Cohort. Urban Arts Leadership is a program of the Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance, directed by Kabubi Ajunku and funded by the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm once again sitting here with Kayla Fryer, Liz Dunlap, Kelly Palmer, Bintu Kuyate, Renz Balagdas, and Miss the amazing
Barbara.
Miss Barbara Hunter.
Barbara
yes.
Hunter. Yes.
And I would just like to thank you so much from all of us. Like, this has been, you're amazing. You have so much wisdom. Thank you. Like, thank you.
I hope I gave you enough.
You did more than enough.
I got something to chew on, but it is officially 2:18, February 24th, and thank you so much, Ms. Hunter.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I made this pantsuit.
Hello, Ms. Barbara Hunter. We are here with Urban Arts Leadership under GBCA, led by Kabubi Ajunku, on February 24th, 2020. May we have your permission to record you for your interview and take your photo?
Yes, you may.
Thank you.
Thank you.